You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Josh Weinberg, Vice President of the Union for Reform Judaism for Israel and Reform Zionism, and Executive Director of ARTSA, the Association of Reform Zionists of America. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's midsummer now, which also means it will be Bastille Day this coming week, July 14th, the National Independence Day for France. And wouldn't it be nice to be vacationing in France right about now? So close your eyes, unless, of course, you're driving right now, and think, if you would, for a moment about France. You know, the Arc de Triomphe, the bridges over the Seine, the Eiffel Tower, wonderful wine, great cheese, croissant with jam and coffee, great food, great art, lovely countryside, bicycle riders, a musical language, the tricolor flag, beautiful cities, and very rude people. You know, France, far from the heat of a Western summer. In time for Bastille Day, July 14th. And so you ask, Rabbi, just what possible Jewish meaning can this have on a show called Too Jewish? Aha, I say. Ha-ha, I should probably say. You probably don't know this, but the very first nation in the old world to guarantee full citizenship to Jews was revolutionary France. And without that dramatic French Revolution of 1789, Jewish history in Europe would have been, well, very different. We are grateful to our own country of America, of course, whose 4th of July we celebrated last week. But we should retain great respect for the country that created the first Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which benefited our people in particular. My favorite weird historical question that most people don't get is this one. Who broke down the walls of the ghettos of Europe, walls that had existed since the 1500s? Who was it that emancipated the Jews of Western Europe? The answer is Napoleon Bonaparte. You see, when Napoleon was conquering Europe in the 1790s and early 1800s, his armies were fighting, at least in theory, for liberty, equality, and fraternity. Napoleon himself had no love for religion in general, and certainly not for the old order of the church that had enforced so many terrible rules and constraints on Jews throughout the Middle Ages and Renaissance and into early modern times. And while Bonaparte had no particular regard one way or the other for Jews, he was, after all, a non-commissioned officer from the island of Corsica originally, with little exposure to them. Napoleon had a very strong sense of the necessity to break down the old bad order, and that revolution that had catapulted him to power certainly dictated that. As Napoleon said, to the Jews as a commune, that is, as a people, nothing. To the Jew as an individual citizen of France, all rights and privileges. That was a very great change and a great gift, particularly at that time in that world. And so as the French armies crossed Europe, conquering, plundering, and establishing their own governments everywhere, they also, almost as an afterthought, broke down the walls of every ghetto they encountered and let the Jews out. And they established, for a period of time, a new legal system, the Code Napoleon, which allowed Jews to go to universities for the first time, to serve in the military, to be part of the civil service, to dress as they liked, to live wherever they wanted, to be full citizens. It was an extraordinarily important moment in Jewish history. France enabled us to enter the modern world, at least wherever its armies held sway, and the ghetto walls were never established in quite the same way again, or with quite the same force, until Hitler came along so many years later. That meant that we Jews could experience everything the modern world had to offer, and kind of all of a sudden. It made possible the extraordinary successes and accomplishments and experiences of modernity in Judaism. It was while Napoleon controlled Germany that Reform Judaism was born, an Enlightenment form of Jewish belief and practice that catalyzed all modern Judaism, either inspired by Reform Judaism or in reaction against it. In the long run, it was this that made possible Zionism and the State of Israel. It was earth-shaking. And it was all because of France. Nowadays, you will often hear a great deal of anti-French rhetoric in Jewish circles. There is certainly anti-Semitism there. The Muslim immigrants perpetrate acts against Jews, sometimes murderous ones. France supports the Arabs too much, and so on. Many French Jews have actually purchased apartments in Israel as a protection from the rise of Muslim anti-Semitism in France, especially in places like Netanya. But in truth, Jewry in France is a much more nuanced picture than that. It remains the largest Jewish community in all of Europe, with Paris the largest Jewish population of any city in Europe, and France retains a vital Jewish communal life. A recent, semi-recent past president, Nicolas Sarkozy, had Jewish ancestors and did a tremendous job countering anti-Semitism and improving Holocaust education, as well as building the French relationship with Israel. François Hollande continued that work. We continue to hope that Jewish life in France, which has flourished since Roman times, will continue to be vibrant and vital. Bastille Day on July 14th also provides us a wonderful excuse to play a comedy cut from one of our all-time favorite Jewish comedians, the late and very great Alan Sherman. Here's a special tribute to France and Bastille Day itself. When the French overthrew the tyranny of King Louis XVI, at least that's how legend has it, the facts may be slightly different, but so what? The song is called You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis.
Louis the 16th was the king of France in 1789. He was worse than Louis the 15th. He was worse than Louis the 14th. He was worse than Louis the 13th. He was the worst since Louis the 1st. King Louis was living like a king, but the people were living rotten. So the people, they started an uprising, which they called the French Revolution. And of course, you remember their battle cry, which will never be forgotten. You went the wrong way, old King Louis. The population cried, 'cause all you did was sit and pet with Marie Antoinette in your place at Versailles. And now the country's gone kablooey, so we are giving you the air that ought to teach you not to spend all your time fooling around at the Folies Bergères. If you had been a nicer king, we wouldn't do a thing. But you were bad, you must admit. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine and shorten you a little bit. You came the wrong way, old King Louis, and now you ain't got far to go. Too bad you won't be here to see that great big Eiffel Tower or Brigitte Bardot. King Louis, we say fooey. You disappointed all of France. But then what else could we expect from a king in silk stockings and pink satin pants? You filled your stomach with chop suey and also crepe Suzette's and steak. And when they told your wife Marie that nobody had bread, she said, let them eat cake. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine. It's somewhere in the heart of town. And when that fella there is through with what he's gonna do, you'll have no place to wear your crown. You came the wrong way, old King Louis. Now we must put you on the shelf. That's why the people are revolting, 'cause Louis, you're pretty revolting yourself.
Never let it be said that Too Jewish doesn't provide the finest in sophisticated Jewish culture at all times and seasons. That was Alan Sherman's You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis, as a fitting capstone to our Bastille Day commemoration and mini-history of French Jewry. When we come back on Too Jewish in a moment, our guest, Rabbi Josh Weinberg, Vice President of the Reform Movement for Israel and Reform Zionism, and the Executive Director of ARTSA, the Association of Reform Zionists of America, will join us. Tell us all about what's going on in Israel now and how exciting it is for Reform Judaism. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our very own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone all over again. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. with Torah study before at 9 a.m. in person and on Zoom, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A Tucson, and we will continue to hold our services open to everyone with full music, both in person and, of course, virtually as well. Our Adult Education Academy classes are all live and available on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's www.BeitSimchaTucson.org, or email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in person and in blended formats, and we are registering kids for the coming fall season that begins in August. Students can be live or on Zoom. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our wonderful religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and in blended format on Zoom, and of course, all of our services live and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish community and congregation in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Josh Weinberg is, I want to say, a friend of long standing. I'm told not to say old friends anymore. Vice President of the Union for Reform Judaism for Israel and Reform Zionism and Executive Director of ARTSA. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hi, good morning. A pleasure to be here.
Josh, you went back to Israel recently after not having been there throughout the whole pandemic time, I think. Tell us, first of all, just what was that experience like?
Yes, thank you. I had not been there almost a year and a half, which is rare for me. And not only as a result of the pandemic, but also with the surge in recent violence between Israel and Hamas, and Israel coming under attack with the largest barrage of rockets it had ever seen, really, since the 2006 Second Lebanon War, we just decided that it would be important to show up, it would be important to support Israel, and to support our movement, and to get a better sense firsthand of some of the shared society projects that our movement is doing, what's going on in East Jerusalem, and to be there also for our groups and for our people there. So it was a really wonderful experience, exhilarating. We were, of course, there on the day that Yitzhak Buzi Herzog was elected as the next president of the State of Israel, and also when the government was presented to the president of Israel. So it was a very, very exciting moment.
Very interesting. Tremendous change, actually, in Israel after really kind of cycling through a lot more of the same for a long time. That has both promise and challenge for the reform movement in Israel, wouldn't you say?
Very, very much so. I would say that we are excited and enthused and hopeful by the change of the government, and I'm happy to elaborate. But I would first say that it's a combination of both who's in and, no less significant, who is out of the government. And that's important to take into consideration.
I should note, you know, another kind of historic first. We have the first Reform rabbi ever to serve in the Knesset, Gilad Kariv. Just so many kind of changes right now. We will talk much more about them and about changes within the Reform movement as well in Israel when we come back in a moment with Rabbi Josh Weinberg. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Jewish community of Naples, which is very interesting and has always complicated history. We brought them up to just about contemporary times, obviously in the Holocaust and during the fascist period, things were probably not very good for them. Tell us a little bit, though, about some of the unique aspects of that community.
So first of all, it's important to talk about the notion of community, because when we say the Jewish community of Tucson or the Jewish community of the United States, we're not talking about a legal entity, like an organization that pays taxes. And
we're not talking about an organized situation either at all, right?
We're talking about people who either define themselves or are defined by others as Jews who happen to live in a certain geographic area. It doesn't mean anything more structured than that. Whereas in Europe, particularly in Western Europe, a Jewish community is a legal entity to which Jews are required to register and pay taxes. And so the community is funded through taxes that are paid to the community rather than to the state. And Jews are counted. Everybody has to be registered with one religious community or another. You're not sort of allowed by law to be unaffiliated. So this tradition means that when you talk about the Jewish community of Naples, you're also talking about like an office or an office building, which owns property, which collects taxes, which solves legal disputes, which does all kinds of things that our Jewish communities don't, by and large, do. And the Jewish community of Naples, in our definition of Jews who live there today, is only a few hundred people. I don't know whether it's 250 or 350, but it's
small,
bigger than a handful, but it's not as big as it once was. And that's partially because of the Holocaust and partially because Naples went through such a hard time economically in the 20th century. So Jews moved voluntarily elsewhere in Italy or to neighboring countries for economic reasons mostly. But what's left of the Jewish community is now in charge of all Jewish affairs in southern Italy, including Sicily. And quite recently, like within the past decade, the Jewish community of Naples opened a branch office in Palermo, recognizing that there was a renaissance of Jewish life going on there, and that because Sicilians consider themselves really a different nation from Italy, if the Jewish community of Naples wanted to be in control of what was going on in Sicily, they had to have a local office. So they have an office now in Palermo, which assists in the development of a Judaic studies program at the University of Palermo, the new synagogue, community activities, whatever. And that is basically a branch office of the larger Jewish community in Naples. But Naples, in terms of Jewish life, was weirdly never a major flourishing center, not even to the extent that Rome and Milano and other places in northern Italy.
Florence, for example. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Interesting. And now they're in control of a very large area with not a huge number of Jews. I think it's a fair statement.
Right. A lot of Jewish property and Jewish
monuments and cemeteries and such.
Remains. Like Jewish cultural heritage, but not many living Jews.
Yeah, just because you have a Judaica doesn't mean you have any Jews left.
Right.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two bees meet in a field. One says to the other, "How are things with you?" "Really bad," says a second bee. "The weather's cold, wet, damp. There's no flowers. I can't make honey." "No problem," says the first bee. "Fly down 5 blocks and turn left. Keep going until you see the cars. There's a bar mitzvah going on. There are all kinds of fresh flowers there." "Thanks for the tip," says the second bee, and flies away. An hour later, the two bees run into each other again. The first bee asks, "How did it go?" "Great," says the second bee. "It was everything you said it would be. There was such huge floral arrangements on every table. Oy, it was great." "Great, great," says the first bee, "but what's that thing on your head?" "Oh, that's my yarmulke," says the second bee. "I didn't want them to think I was a wasp." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Wear your yarmulke. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin the great final book of the Torah, Dvarim, or Deuteronomy, also known as Mishneh Torah. The people of Israel have arrived at the very borders of the Promised Land, and our great leader Moses begins a long sermon, 3 actually, that will carry us forward through the entire book of Deuteronomy. If you thought some rabbis' sermons were long-winded, try this. Moses' first speech in Deuteronomy starts this Shabbat and doesn't conclude until next Saturday. That is by far the shortest of his sermons in Devarim, by the way. Moses begins by employing that most Jewish of devices, guilt. God has led our people to the very borders of the Promised Land, taken care of all of the Israelites' physical needs, worked wonders and miracles for them, and yet they have repeatedly failed to keep faith with God. You know the story. After all, these are the children of Israel. They don't call, they don't write, they don't send cards. In spite of all the love lavished on the Israelites, they never really accepted God's presence. In spite of everything God has done, from miraculous salvation on the shores of the Sea of Reeds, the great revelation at Sinai, the 40 years of manna in the desert, they remain ungrateful and unaware. And now, as they stand at the very gateway of the Promised Land, they Still don't get it. To correct this problem, or at least attempt to do so, in our portion of Devarim, Moses begins to lay out the so-called Deuteronomic Covenant. It forms the core of his last, best effort to convince our people they should recognize God's presence and keep the faith. Remember, he says repeatedly, listen, hear my words, pay attention. God is with you. God cares. Have faith. In next week's portion of Vayet Hanan, Moses will reach true eloquence. In a perfect phrase, he will make it all astonishingly clear. Hear, people of Israel, Adonai is our God and God is one. Shema, listen, hear. What is hearing, really, but the auditory awareness of the presence, the voice of another? What is our task but learning how to listen for God's whisper in the world? The covenant we're given in Deuteronomy has a mixed reputation these days. It's a very simple formula, really. If we believe in God and act ethically, we'll be rewarded. If we stray from God's mitzvot, we'll be punished. This form of divine covenant doesn't play so well today. It promises good things happen to good people while bad things will happen to bad people, which we know from our own experience isn't always or even often true. But I would suggest that a more profound reading of Devarim teaches us Moses' real message, the Ikar, the heart of this lesson, that our fundamental failure is not doing immoral things and being punished for them. It is, instead, failing to be aware of God's presence in our world. That, of course, is something our ancestors struggled with repeatedly. When they saw great miracles enacted before their eyes, they managed to recognize God's hand in the world. Yet, within a few days, as Moses reminds them in our portion of Devarim, they managed to forget God had done much of anything for them at all, and they started to kvetch. And as hard as it was for our ancestors to sense God's presence, it is perhaps an even greater challenge today. We are bombarded with information of all kinds by all kinds of devices. Television, email, smartphones, texts, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and on and on. Today, it takes something extra to be able to sense God's presence in our world. And yet, God is here, and no farther away than before. God is in the intricate ways that life flourishes and changes, the ways in which we and nature learn and grow, in the blush of new love, the depth of lifelong devotion. In a child's laugh, in a bubby's hug, in a teen's first kiss, in the expanse of the universe and the small magical beauty of an unfolding blossom, in the thunder and lightning of a rainstorm. In the 12th century, the poet and Torah commentator Ibn Ezra wrote to God, I see you in the starry sky, I see you in the field of rye, in every leaf, in every flower, witness of your matchless power. We fancy you remain concealed, but in all your work you are revealed. And yet we so easily walk or run through this world of wonder and miss God's presence. Devarim teaches us that it is our central task to look and truly see, to listen and really hear. When we come back, Rabbi Josh Weinberg will update us on the many fascinating things happening in the Reform movement in Israel, including revolutionary changes. Find out what they are and how Israel's doing right now when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A violent anti-Semitic attack has the Boston Jewish community in particular outraged. Khalid Awad, accused of stabbing Rabbi Shlomo Naginsky in the arm 8 times outside a Jewish school in Brighton, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston last week, was arrested shortly after the attack outside the Shalom House on Chestnut Hill Avenue. Boston police said he was armed with a knife and a gun. He's charged with assault and battery by means of a dangerous weapon and assault and battery on a police officer. Civil charges may also be filed. Investigators said Awad came up to Rabbi Naginsky during the afternoon in broad daylight, pointed a gun at him, and told him to give him the keys to his school van. The suspect then ordered the victim to walk over to a white van that was parked on Chestnut Hill Avenue, the police report says. The victim and suspect walked toward the van, and the suspect told the victim to get in the van. The rabbi fled, but there was a struggle, and Naginsky was stabbed 8 times in the arm as he tried to run to the park across the street. Prosecutors say Awad has no record in Massachusetts, but faced charges of battery and theft in Florida and was sent to a mental health facility there. It was certainly a harrowing, brazen act in broad daylight in our neighborhood in this community where a member of our community was terrorized, chased, and stabbed numerous times, said the prosecutor. In court, prosecutors also said Awad may face those civil rights charges. He is Egyptian, has been in the United States for 4 years. Rabbi Naginsky was rushed to Boston Medical Center and spent the night recovering, was released the next morning. ADL New England Regional Director Robert Treston said facts were emerging that included multiple indicators pointing towards anti-Semitism. One of them was that Awad's former roommate said Awad is an anti-Semite and a very angry one. Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey and Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins joined 100 other people in the rain for a unity rally on Brighton Common, supporting Rabbi Naginsky. "We will not run. We will hold our ground and defend ourselves and our community," said Robert Treston of the ADL. "We have to recognize anti-Semitism is on the rise. We need to hold people accountable when they do this so that they are made an example of. This attack intends to scare us from Jewish living. It's not going to work. We will continue to live lives," said Sheila Goodman of Combined Jewish Philanthropies. The rabbi, who is Russian-born and in his 50s, is the father of 12 children. "I am grateful to the Boston Police Department for their rapid response and relieved the perpetrators in custody. I look forward to returning to my work as soon as possible," said Rabbi Naginsky. After a roller coaster ride in the Arizona state legislature, including a debate over a controversial definition of anti-Semitism, a bill mandating Holocaust education in Arizona schools will now go to Governor Doug Ducey's office. With the governor's signature, Arizona's public schools will be required to teach about the Holocaust and other genocides at least twice between the 7th and 12th grades. According to the Phoenix Holocaust Association and Arizona State, Arizona will be the 16th state to require Holocaust education by statute. "So many people from so many different parts of the state invested countless hours over the last few years to make sure this happens," said Michael Beller, who co-founded Arizona Teaching the Holocaust for the sole purpose of mandating Holocaust education in Arizona. Arizona House Rep. Alma Hernandez, an old friend, the Jewish Democrat who introduced the bill, called the passage a big win for our community. "I have never been prouder to be an elected official and a Jew in Arizona," she said. "Knowing all Arizona students will learn about the Holocaust gives me hope and restores my faith in humanity, because we must teach the past to ensure it never happens again." Alexander White, a 97-year-old Holocaust survivor who lives in Scottsdale, testified in support of the bill and has been working alongside Beller, Hernandez, and other groups to see it through. "Its passage means a great deal to him. The Holocaust is a prototype of man's inhumanity to man, and young people should know about that," he said. "If it happens once, it can happen again." The Long in the Works bill has been on the verge of being derailed, ironically, by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, the IHRA definition, which is legally non-binding, but includes some forms of anti-Israel speech among its examples of anti-Semitism, was a last-minute addition to the Holocaust education bill. Republican State Senator Paul Boyer had pushed for the inclusion. He wound up being one of only 2 dissenting Senate votes to the final version of the bill, which did not include that definition. Passing the bill without the IHRA definition leaves our legislative intent unfulfilled and vulnerable to exploitation, said Boyer, adding the passage would create a real possibility of seeing the Holocaust education curriculum corrupted in ways that could ironically boost contemporary anti-Semitism rather than combat it. In support of that, he pointed to California's recent passage of its ethnic studies model curriculum. Jewish organizations have complained that the draft of California's curriculum ignored the American Jewish experience and included anti-Semitic language and anti-Israel sections. In other news, Honduras formally moved its Israeli embassy to Jerusalem last week, becoming the 4th country to make that move. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett hosted Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez in a ceremony that also included the foreign ministers of both countries. Hernandez said that since he took office in 2014, Honduras had become one of two countries in Latin America, one of five in the world, that most often abstains from the resolutions that Israel opposes. Bennett said in response, under your leadership, Honduras consistently stands by Israel in international institutions when it is not always popular to do so and sometimes also involves paying a price. This is a testimony to our friendship. Two countries also signed a series of cooperation agreements on agriculture, health, education, and technology. That is the news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Josh Weinberg, is the Vice President of the Union for Reform Judaism for Israel and Reform Zionism and Executive Director of ARTSA. He has, I think I first met you when you were a student representative. You come a long way since then. Tell us what it's, this is a combined position. This is a different position than the way this responsibility has been handled within the Reform Movement before. Can you tell us a little bit about that reorganization, if you will?
So we wanted Israel to be represented at the highest level in our Reform Movement to reflect the traditional notion of three sacred relationships that we hold as Jews, one with God, one with Torah, and one with Israel. And we wanted Israel to be represented not only in our hearts and souls and minds, but also in our structure, in our organizational framework. And so we essentially integrated ARTSA, which was our Zionist wing and still is, into the URJ. And I became part of the executive team of the URJ and trying to really work with our congregations and our youth and to bring Israel to our movement and also to galvanize our movement and mobilize our movement in support of building and expanding the Reform Movement in Israel. So that's essentially what it looks like today.
The growth of the Reform Movement in Israel, first of all, it's worth mentioning again, the Reform Movement is the largest movement in North America of Jews. Far more Jews identify themselves as Reform in the United States and in Canada, for that matter, than any other Jewish identification. But in Israel, of course, those proportions are not the same. Tell us about the challenges and the growth of Reform Judaism in Israel now.
Yeah, so the growth of the Reform movement in Israel has been really exponential over the past couple decades. We have doubled the number of congregations that we have from about 25 to now over 50, even 54 congregations. And we are reaching new audiences, especially during COVID. We saw that more and more Israelis were participating in our tefillot, in our Shabbat, in our holiday celebrations. And of course, we also are really achieving new things with our Israel Religious Action Center, our political and advocacy wing. I would also say that part of the recognition of Reform Judaism in Israel has, in fact, propelled Rabbi Gilad Kariv to serve as the first Reform rabbi in the Knesset, which I can't tell you how meaningful that is. I mean, that is very, very significant right now. He'll have his own challenges, but what we are facing in Israel, of course, is also a renewed sense of extremism, a sense of anti-liberalism, and a sense that there are organizations who are specifically targeting campaigns against the Reform Movement. And they sadly feel very threatened by us, even though more and more of Israeli Jews are turning to us for meaning, for participation, for expression of Jewish life, and for a way to enrich the Jewish existence of Israeli society.
I should note that Yair Lapid, kind of the kingmaker in this government, who was supposed to rotate in as the next prime minister after Naftali Bennett, had his kids bar mitzvah at Beit Daniel and the Reform
Center. Beit Daniel in Tel Aviv, yeah.
That's another first, right?
First of all, he should get a great deal of credit for not giving up and for pushing through this new government. And he is someone with whom we have a very good relationship. And I think he understands the importance of pluralism, first of all, and understands he also understands the importance of liberal Judaism, which is not something that that we should take for granted.
You know, there's been in past governments an attempt to create an egalitarian prayer service at the Davidson Center. And in the various Netanyahu efforts, it always seemed to get close to happening and then was scotched by religious parties in the government. Is there some thought of reviving that effort now that there aren't any religious party, officially religious parties in the government?
There are religious parties, but not officially ultra-Orthodox parties.
Right.
Yeah. Not only is there some thought to it, but it is actually part of the coalition agreement that what was decided 4 years ago, almost 5 years ago now, will be now implemented. And that is extremely significant.
You were back in Israel now after having been gone for probably the longest time. You were out of Israel in quite a while.
Yes.
What changes did you see?
So it was an interesting case of everything is exactly the same and everything is exactly different. Look, Israel had a lot of trauma during the pandemic in terms of several different periods of complete closure. Lots of small businesses were forced to close. And what I saw was a renewed sense of hope that people, you know, things are opening up both figuratively and literally. Things are opening up because of the new government, because of the end of the reign of Prime Minister Netanyahu, which was, you know, really for the past 12 years. I mean, think about kids who grew up in a society in which they only knew Netanyahu as prime minister and don't even remember the 3 years in the 1990s when he was prime minister. And people, there's an excitement in the air that people are getting back to normal. We were also at the Jerusalem Gay Pride Parade, in which, you know, thousands of people came out to the streets. And despite the protests, there was a great deal of excitement in the air. And there's also a renewed sense of partnership, I think, between Israel and the diaspora communities. And that's what we're also particularly excited about.
There does seem to be a different approach to the Jews who live Chutz La'aretz, right? The whole question of diasporic relations with the state of Israel. Do you anticipate that under a Bennett prime ministership that will dramatically change? I mean, Bennett himself lived in New York, made a number of fortunes there. Is that coming from the top?
I think it is. You know, Bennett also served as Minister of Diaspora Affairs in 2013 and 14. And I think he understands the world a little bit better. Yes, his parents grew up in the Reform world, English-speaking in California, and his wife comes from a secular background. And I think he's willing to be much more of a pragmatist, as well as the different, you know, Nachman Shai, who is now the Minister for Diaspora Affairs, is a very good friend of our movement, and really does get diaspora Jewry, which is a welcome change. It's amazing that if you look at the division of ministerial portfolios in this new government, we have lots of people who are actually qualified for their positions.
that might be the first in Israeli history. Who knew that would ever happen?
Which is nice. I mean, usually the defense minister is, you know, uniquely qualified, and then everyone sort of gets what they get. But this time, I think, it is really exciting. And I think that there's an openness to work with the diaspora. That, you know, listen, just a few weeks before this government was formed, we had the former ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, who sat in a public forum and said that, you know, Israel should really give up on its relationship with liberal diaspora Jews and only cater to the evangelicals. Which is a huge problem also for him, because the evangelicals are also changing the next generation. But what kind of a message is that sending? And I think that message is now being reversed, and my hope that it will only grow and strengthen.
In your view, for the Reform movement to continue to develop, What needs to change? I mean, I still think there are plenty of Chiloni Israelis, secular Israelis, who don't even know the Reform movement exists. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. And they may not know it exists, but they may also know that there's a liberal congregation in their neighborhood. You know, I say, oh, right. Or I went to a wedding for a work colleague, and it was conducted, it was officiated by a woman rabbi. So, and that was really nice. And I really liked that. I didn't know that kind of thing could happen. Now we hear all these kind of anecdotes. So what we're seeing from the latest surveys is that close to 800,000 Israelis somehow identify with Reform and Conservative Judaism, even if they may not be what we would call in American parlance, they may not be affiliated, right? That's a word that does not really have a direct Hebrew or Israeli translation. And so even if they don't know there's a movement, and you know what? I would be interested to see how many Reform Jews in America are actually aware of the movement. I don't mean to be self-critical about that for our movement, but sometimes members of Reform congregations, you know, they say, I don't know. I'm just a member of the congregation that's in my neighborhood. And we like it a lot. I don't know if it's Reform or whatever. And so I'm less worried about that. I think that will come once we start to reach more Jews and more people, and they see us as a plausible, as a really meaningful expression as for what it means to be Jewish. Because I'll say two things. One is that Israelis are waking up now to the reality that this polarizing dichotomy between religious, you know, / Orthodox and secular really no longer answers the needs of the mainstream. And the second thing is that having a state of Israel, having a Jewish state, doesn't necessarily mean having a Jewish community. And so I think Israelis are looking for similar things that Jews in the diaspora are looking for. They're looking for meaning. They're looking for education. They're looking for community to celebrate Shabbat, life cycles, holidays, all of those things together. And they're finding that in the Reform movement.
You know, I was thinking, could have answered that another way, which is lots and lots of American Jews say they're affiliated with Reform congregations, but don't actually belong.
That's interesting.
If everybody who says they're Reform in America actually belonged and came to Shul, we'd need to be in a giant building campaign in the United States.
Right, especially in the last Pew study.
Especially. The pandemic, Israel handled the pandemic about as well as any country on the planet, really. Do the Israelis feel that way about it?
I think the Israelis look at the mass vaccination effort and look at that with a great sense of pride as to how they handled it. And that credit goes a lot to Prime Minister Netanyahu, who really cut the deal himself with the CEO of Pfizer and also with Moderna to bring vaccinations to the entire country to anyone who wanted that. In terms of whether they handled the pandemic is another story, I think. There were lots of fits and spurts and, you know, a great deal of closures, and small businesses paid the price. Whole big debacle with the ultra-Orthodox in terms of schools opening and who needs to behave according to the regulations set out by the state. And that was a big problem. It was not for nothing that we saw a shot in the arm of the Israeli protest culture during this pandemic, where every Saturday night there were massive protests outside the prime minister's residence, having a lot to do with how he was handling the pandemic. Interestingly enough, Prime Minister Bennett now, he wrote a book during this pandemic on how to handle the pandemic, which, full disclosure, I have not read in full, but he had at least a proposal of how this should be handled, whether it was listened to or not. So overall, I would give them a very good grade, and we are very proud of the vaccination rate, and hopefully now more vaccines will come to the Palestinians, hopefully quickly. There's been talk of that in the news now. But I wouldn't look with, you know, totally shining light over the entire pandemic and how it handled it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely fair. And it's also true that this was a very complicated time. Josh, I feel like we just scratched the surface. I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the Reform Movement and Artsa and URJ's efforts in these areas?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. You can go to artsa.org, and I write a weekly newsletter with commentaries on the Torah portion in Israeli politics. We'd love for you to sign up there. We'd love for everyone to become a member of Artsa. It's like being a member of our Reform Zionist party, essentially, saying that the values that we espouse of tolerance, equality, freedom, pluralism, all of those things, democracy, that you are in favor of those in Israel also and help support our work there. So that can be at artsa.org. And of course, at urj.org and reformjudaism.org. And Rabbi Cohen, thank you so much for inviting me. And all of my best regards for all of the people in Tucson and all of the world who tune in. And I hope you can stay cool a little bit in this blistering heat that you're experiencing.
From your mouth to God's ears. Thanks so much, Rabbi Weinberg. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Joshua Henkin, author of the wonderful new novel, Morningside Heights. Our playout this morning comes for, you know, Bastille Day from the French Jewish Gypsy Yiddish group Les Yeux Noirs. Their beautiful song, Liebkeit, La Tendresse. And don't forget that you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat, starting at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services and Torah reading, followed by Kiddush. But you can also find us on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Men ken leben ohne Groschen, ohne dire Geld. Mit Gur nicht in die Taschen und frei in die Welt. Ha doch Leben ohne Liebkeit, du's kann Gur nicht sein. Nein, 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 du's kann Gur nicht sein. Mir kann Leben ohne Masel, es ist nicht a Feile. Mir kann sein a Schlemasel und treffen die Zrie. Ha doch Leben ohne Liebkeit, du's kann gar nicht sein. Nein, 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 du's kann gar nicht sein. Du siehst doch, es ist Krankheit, Liebe auf den ersten Blick. Du siehst doch, es ist Schwachheit, wenn sie geht mir a Kick. Richtig, richtig. Mir kann Leben wie a Ganef, wie a Schnorrer, a Zar. Und schlech war bringe du's Leben, es ist nicht kein Nacht. Ha doch Leben ohne Liebkeit, du's kann gar nicht sein. Du's kann gar nicht sein. On peut vivre sans richesse, presque sans le sou. Des seigneurs et des princesses, y en a plus beaucoup. Mais vivre sans tendresse, on ne le pourrait pas. Non, 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 on ne le pourrait pas. On peut vivre sans la gloire qui ne prouve rien. être inconnu dans l'histoire et s'en trouver bien. Adochlem une Liebkeit, dus kann gar nicht sein. Nein, 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 dus kann gar nicht sein.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.